Good to go? All right. Oh, yeah, that's a hand signal. My name is Eric Blind. I am 35 years old. Today is June 26, 2010. We're here in the Presidio of San Francisco in the new Archaeology Lab building. And I'm with Ruth Tringham, who is my professor over at Berkeley, my graduate advisor, and a good friend of mine.
My name is Ruth Tringham. I'm 69 years old, although I don't feel it. Today is the 26th of June, 2010, and we are in the Presidio of San Francisco, sitting in the archaeology lab, and very nice new building. And my relationship to Eric Blind is I am his colleague. I am also the supervisor of his graduate studies. And he is also a very good friend.
I like the beginning. Okay. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask just kind of to get us going is if you can either remember the first time you came to the Presidio and what you imagined when you got here, or maybe just a favorite memory. It doesn't necessarily have to be the first of coming to this place.
Well, you know I'm a historian, Eric, so I have to start at the beginning and then go on from there, but I won't go too far. I came to California in 1978, and actually, even during that year or very soon after, I was invited to the Presidio to a dinner at some colonel's house. It was when the Presidio was an army fort, and I was sort of nervous at coming to the U.S. Army base. But nobody ever stopped me. I just drove in, and I found with difficulty the house, but I never saw the main post. Then, can you imagine? It was like 20 years later that I actually came to the Presidio again. This was in 1999, something like that, 2000, when the excavations, Barb Voss's excavations, were going on over in the, I can't remember the name of the street now, but...
Funston.
Yes, the Funston Street. Yeah. And I came to visit the excavations and actually was also visiting Amy Ramsey, who was one of my supervisees at that time. And that was the next time. Then again, I didn't come at all until 2005 or perhaps 6, when you were working with Michael Ashley, and I came over then, and it was perhaps to start a collaboration with you, and it was a completely different feeling then, was just, you know, now I saw the whole of the Presidio. You took us on a tour, and this time I went over into the old military psychology ward, the psychiatric ward, and had the joy of seeing where the old psychiatric patients used to do their exercising. And you offered this as a place where we might want to have our research base. And I thought then, ew.
I do remember that. So as you started coming back to the Presidio more and more and got more involved with our program and bringing classes here, can you recall a time that you felt connected to a particular place at the Presidio, or that somehow the Presidio had a certain personal connection for you?
Well, I suppose, I mean, I've always been interested in military history for some reason. I don't know quite why. And this was something that I felt that this was a place that I could be very close to history of the last 300 years in North America in a way that I had never felt before. So it gave me a completely different attitude to U.S. history. It was more emotionally connected. I suppose seeing something like the gun emplacements of the First World War, Second World War, and, you know, having been on the other end, with, I don't remember it at all, of the Second World War in Europe, but to see it here in the Pacific was very moving, I found. One of the things which I also found really connective is, I don't know, there was one day that we were working in the El Presidio time of the late 1700s, and we were talking about the Native American workers and how they came from Mission Dolores. And then there was this whole conversation about, you could hear the bells from Mission Dolores at San Francisco, from the San Francisco Presidio, rather. And I thought, now, we'd never be able to hear those bells because there's so much noise. And then I sort of felt this whole connection between, that made me feel a connection between San Francisco, the city where I'd been living since 1980, and the Presidio of San Francisco that I had never felt before.
Wow.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
But you know, you can hear the foghorn of San Francisco Bay from the other end, the southeast corner of San Francisco where I live. So there is that whole, it's this whole kind of senses of place. What can you hear in the city and what can't you hear? It was a really interesting connection.
Oh, wow. Mm. I know you like to do a lot of your research kind of revolves around kind of the senses and trying to get multiple senses involved, you know, in your research and people's understanding of the past. It was the bells. That was the one that really...
That was something that really struck me. And there are many other kinds of things. And in fact, one of the reasons why I started to work here or get interested in coming back to San Francisco to do more research to San Francisco Presidio, to do more research, was that this was a place where I could actually put into practice a lot of the senses of place research, or senses of place in the past, the kind of research that I'd wanted to do over in Turkey where I was working and couldn't really put it into practice, you know, on that kind of community scale. So the Presidio seemed to me a kind of potential place where I could do that. And of course, there were people very sympathetic like yourself who was just encouraging me to be wilder and wilder in my research aims like this.
Oh, that's great. So, you know, as you've come to get, you know, further involved in the program and go out on these whims, can you recall kind of a moment, an event, or a certain collaboration that helped you kind of reconfigure your understanding of the Presidio's past?
Well, yes, I have to tell you, Eric, that you were very, very instrumental in doing this. You welcomed me after that conference that where we first met in Stanford. It was the Archaeology of Vision, and we first met there and got talking about the senses of vision, touch, audio, and so on, and how important that was in the past and in sharing the past with other people, such as visitors to a heritage place like San Francisco Presidio. And I got very excited by this, and then I came here, and you are such a magnificent storyteller that it was just, you just transformed my whole impression of the Presidio as a really interesting place that was full of stories, and stories that had yet to be understood, or stories that had yet to be told. And I just thought, my goodness, this is a place I would really like to just spend a lot of time exploring those stories. There was, of course, there were some stories that I started taking off from that you wouldn't let me take off from. There was one about that the general's burned house. What was his name?
General Pershing.
General Pershing, poor General Pershing. His house burned down when he was busy fighting the war in Mexico, and all his wife and children were burned in it. And you thought of this as you told me that story, and we saw the place where the house was supposed to have stood. And I was really amazed at this story, that nobody had thought of the reason why did this house burn down. Then that was a connection between the research that I'd been doing in Southeast Europe, where people burned their houses down deliberately as a way to bury the houses and make sure that the houses could be seen in future generations because it made such a mess. And that, but this connection here, so when I hear about General Pershing's house burned down, I immediately think there's got to be a reason why General Pershing's house burned down. It doesn't just happen by accident, not a big house like that burned to the ground. Yeah. So my first theory was, following all of these, my mystery novel interest is, surely somebody did it deliberately to draw him away from the war in Mexico as a political statement. And you, Eric, said to me, nonsense, it's nothing like that. It was an accident and you don't want to go there. So I'm determined to go there sometime, but not now. But anyway, and we got off the point probably, but...
No. I will learn better than to stand in your way. So is that, would you consider that kind of a time that you were frustrated in your efforts to convey a bit of
the Presidio's past? Yes, jumping ahead to another question. Yes, that was a time when I was frustrated, but I am never frustrated to the extent that I'm not going to keep on at that question. And at some point, I know that we'll be excavating General Pershing's burned ruins, and won't we?
Mm-hmm,
there you go. So I have it on tape now, or at least on record. But so this idea that there are archaeology is very frustrating anyway. You know, there are all these questions that we want to ask, all this information that we want to find out, and stories that we'd like to be able to tell about people's daily lives, and we can't because we don't have the information. Where I work in prehistoric Turkey or Southeast Europe, we have very little information, just fragments. But here in the Presidio, you have documents, you have a lot more, but it's still very frustrating if you can't always get your hands on those documents. And that can be frustrating, but I think that's all changing now.
I have to say, one of the things I've always been impressed with is, you know, as you've mentioned, you know, you work on sites in Turkey that are many thousands of years old, and prehistoric settlements in Southeast Europe. And you've been able to take some of the approaches that you developed there and apply them to a place here in the Presidio that's, you know, at its surface seems so different. And I was just wondering if you could talk just a little bit about how you've kind of made this a little bit of a transition and applied some of these interesting multi-sensory understandings of place to seemingly a very different place.
Well, it's a lot of that ability to transfer the knowledge and the interest from prehistoric Eastern Europe and Turkey to the San Francisco Presidio comes is really based also in my interest in sharing, being able to share how I make my interpretations of archaeological data, to share that process with the public. And that's something I wanted to do in Turkey and in Southeast Europe, and did to a certain extent through digital technology, through web publication. But here at the Presidio, it seems that the potential to do it is much greater because we have here, because we're right near a city, we have different kinds of internet technology and digital materials. We have resources right here at our doorstep, and the possibility of collaborating with people that we don't have in the field in those other places. So a lot of what I'm interested in is the digital documentation and the multimedia expression and representation of the past. And that's what I've really been interested in transferring, that the interest from what I did in prehistory or what I do in prehistory to the archaeology of the San Francisco Presidio, it's still archaeology. The problems, the challenges, and the potential of sharing with the public is still the same. The process of interpretation is still the same. It doesn't matter that the data is more fragmentary there and less here, or more dependent on documents here than there. The process of how we document that and how we share that is still the same. And the process of how we interpret it in terms of the senses of place. The senses are the same. You know, they're not any different just because they're slightly later in the past, later in history than there. However, the other thing that was very interesting for me was to be able to really put that into practice here in a way I couldn't in Southeast Europe or Turkey. And one of the ways I put that into practice was through teaching summer school courses, which you very generously allowed me to do. And so we taught for three summers. We taught some summer school courses for UC Berkeley at the Presidio, and actually sort of taught the students or guided them how to critically analyze the data, the media sources, and the other documents from in terms of archaeological information or stories about the past. And you took one of those courses, I think that was in just before you became a graduate student at Berkeley. And you created, all the students had to create these 5-minute films about the Presidio. And it was fantastic. It was something we couldn't possibly really have done except right on our doorstep. It was a non-residential course. And so students, you know, went back each day, and then, but it was just something that would have been very difficult to do outside of the city. And then the other two courses were about documenting, guiding students, teaching them how to document digitally in a very structured way, very rigorous way, how to actually document what they saw or what they found, and document the process by which they interpreted them and so on, using digital technology. And, you know, this is the way of the future. It's got to be done like that. And it was great. It was a way of me looking to see what could I do, what could I contribute to what was going on at the Presidio. So, and then you invited me to try this interpretive plan at the Presidio, which was fantastic. I loved working with Adrian Priscellis on that. And it was all a sort of series of dreams, you know, how would we really like to have an interpretive trail around the El Presidio what would we like to have? And of course, Adrian and I are very much into interpretation and being able to let your imagination fly, but in a rigorous way, you know, basing it on the archaeological information. And that was such a joy to write that, because I thought, well, maybe this can actually happen. It wasn't just a dream. It could actually, this was something, because I live here, it's right here on my doorstep, and the people are supportive at the Presidio, we could actually do some really, really interesting stuff that I couldn't do in other places.
Oh, wow, that's great. So with all the the students that you've kind of guided here at the Presidio, I like how you say guided. I've always appreciated that. and taught at the Presidio and learned from their projects. Mm-hmm. Has it changed the way that you understand this place or its past as you've seen these stories come to life, these bits of history kind of get teased apart in movies and and different bits of documentation? Has it changed how you appreciate it?
Oh, entirely. Entirely. I mean, I come here when we have visitors, I bring them to the Presidio. I say, it's a really interesting place. There are all these things, these stories about it, and I try to remember the stories you told us and then repeat them probably in a garbled sense, but I try. But it's just the kinds of things that we've done in the El Presidio project and the Pauline just doing the interpretation of that, and just being able to explore the many, many different stories. And then other stories have come up during the other courses, like the stories of Fort Scott. I didn't even know before I taught that course in 2007, where is Fort Scott? I thought I had to find it, and that nobody else seemed to know either. I couldn't get a straight answer on where is Fort Scott, and of course it's very clear where it is. But this is a huge, rich resource of stories over there, and just the history of that time. And it's a completely different time from the El Presidio time. You know, you've got here 300 years of history, which I had been entirely unaware of before. And now I'm very, very aware of the different periods and how that affected the landscape, and imagining all the different architectures that have gone through, especially because this is all parallel with your whole study in the Officers Club, you know, that the room, mm-hmm. the Mesa room, mm-hmm. which is so fantastic, just because there you're showing in a nutshell all of the different architectural styles, really the different lives of the people there. I love that. And then when we did the study of the media literacy, the students went off and found stuff that I didn't know about the launderettes. I didn't know about that. And one of the things I loved was the connections. This really has made a huge difference to me, the connections that are all there between San Francisco, the city, or Yerba Buena, or whatever it was called, and San Francisco Presidio. I lived in San Francisco, as I said, since 1980, and I never visited the Presidio. And yet now I realize that the San Francisco Presidio is an integral part of the history of San Francisco in a way that I had no idea. It's intertwined incredibly. There's one of the students in the media literacy course did a film on Chinatown. And Chinatown has connections with the San Francisco Presidio. You know, this whole thing, it was not separated at all. And that's something that I have learned and I'm very grateful for. I'm now much more interested in San Francisco history than I ever was. What it's done is to give me a very different attitude to living in San Francisco than I had before 2000, really, and that has nothing to do with becoming a citizen. The whole working at the Presidio has allowed me to feel very, very proud and definitely part of being a San Franciscan. I feel that I am a native, or now as much as one can ever be a native of San Francisco. And the Presidio has done that for me. You know, I'm no longer, and I don't feel myself, in spite of the accent, an expatriate. I know I speak beautifully, but that has nothing to do with my feeling of identity. I don't feel myself identified with the place where my accent comes from, nearly as much as I feel a part of San Francisco.
Wow, that's amazing. And through your work here, it's
mm-hmm, that's what did it
made
it
realize
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, well, that's fascinating. So, you know, kind of on that same thread of how you've come to identify with the city because of your work here, is there any spot, a real particular place at the Presidio that I don't know that helps you with that feeling, or is there any you know, I guess I'm kind of looking for maybe your favorite place within the Presidio, or something that has really resonated for you?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, you're going to laugh if I tell you.
Oh, I promise I won't.
Yes, you will. Okay. It's because it's in the car park. There's this spot which was the jailhouse in the California during the early 1800s fort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remember with the bigger one, the bigger when the El Presidio is expanded to make a larger quadrangle.
And there's the smaller one we
And you've
painted?
Got the smaller one, yeah. That's right, okay. And inside. And you actually drew the smaller one on the car park. I thought that was brilliant. It really is, because anyone with imagination, you're standing, there's something about standing in the place under which the prison, the jailhouse is. And there's this, and you get this feeling of, really, it's been part of it. It's that corner, or the corner where the there are various little rooms there, and they're identified on the map as what they were. And there's the governor's room where I can't remember. This is during them where the daughter who fell in love with the Russian commandant,
lived. Arguello's daughter.
And you can kind of imagine that. So those are those places, and that's one of the things I love to do. That I love to sort of still go and stand around when one can, when there aren't cars there, stand in there in that area. And I think that would be something that would be great to try to develop for. I'm sure I'm not alone in feeling that. I'm sure that other people could be drawn into that whole imaginary. This is where it was. Idea.
Oh, yeah. I think this is an indicator of you being young at heart. I was just talking to a kid yesterday, and he said part of their school program, they go, Katie puts them in that room, and then they'll pretend like they're locked in it and they can't get out.
There you go. See, well, yes, I know. I am a sort of child at heart. I mean, I'm still a frustrated puppeteer, which is why I'm so interested in multimedia. And another favorite place I have to tell you, one more favorite place is over in the Fort Scott area. I found that Fort Scott area quite strong emotionally, passion, sort of got interesting emotions, senses of place there, because I suppose it's less changed, less entirely destroyed than some of the other places. I know, you know, it's very recent history, but there are two places over there that I found, three places, and they have to do with, you were going to ask me about experiences with students. Did I have any interesting experience with students? Well, there's one of the places is the Officers Club of Fort Scott, which has this fantastic ballroom. I know you've got a ballroom here in the other Officers Club, and it's very large. That one's much smaller. And there was, when we were doing the course on Fort Scott in 2007, one group of students was supposed to be documenting the officers' club. They were in there, and I went along to keep an eye, you know, see what they were up to. And they're kind of futzing around and trying to think, what were they, you know, well, what would this have been, and what would this room have been? So I encouraged them, and we all started dancing around in the ballroom, as though we were in a 1911 ball. And we were singing some ballroom song and dancing. It was very fun. It has a lot of ghosts, that building. So that's one. And then there's another place that doesn't have anything to do with students, but I found really somewhere where I could, I don't know, I just had a feeling about it. And it's a place where they played handball, I think. It's near where the tennis courts are. And it's like a handball court, and it's sort of overgrown, and obviously nobody ever plays anything down there. But you walk down some steps, and you come to this sort of forgotten court thing, very strange area. You know the one
I
mean?
I do.
So I found that full of ghosts, too. Then there's another place where during the Fort Scott course again, the two students were supposedly looking at one of the gun emplacement areas. Not gun emplacement, it's a place, yeah, it must have been a gun emplacement, yeah, where they stored ammunition. Mm-hmm. And there's a little guardhouse there that was completely overgrown. And so one day I went with these students and we started clearing all of the sort of brambles and nettles and so on off this building. And it was fantastic to watch these students. They had never done anything like this before, and they're kind of clearing this and finding this, finally, this little guardhouse or signals station, house where they would, the guy would send the signal of how they were supposed to get the guns ready for shooting. Of course, they never did shoot anything, but anyway. So we revealed this little signal station, and immediately we're all in there pretending we are signals people. it was really silly, but it's just, you know, you can do that here. There are these places that seem to be forgotten and yet suddenly get revealed. And that's, you know, it's what we do in archaeology. We suddenly reveal places that have been hidden for many years. It's great. So there's a ton of potential here.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's great. Oh, those are great stories. Yeah, there is something magical about finding those spots that still have yet to be discovered.
I know you like doing it too, because I think you may even have helped us that day.
Oh my, can I see your...
Yes.
I have a question. Yeah. Eric, what do you remember about the first time you met Ruth?
The first time? Oh my gosh. I was working...
Wasn't it at that Stanford thing?
Yeah, that was the first time. But I remember the first time I recall meeting you here was I was working in the Mesa room and with Michael, like you said, and I knew very much about you and your work, and I remember he said Professor Tringham might come by. And I was, oh my goodness, Professor Tringham might come by. And I was thinking, oh gosh, he works on these 9,000-year-old houses. And here I am dinking around with this 200-year-old adobe house. And how could she possibly be interested or impressed with this? And immediately you came in. And I remember you said, this looks just like those places in Chateauneuf. Look at those bricks. And I remember I was very proud at that moment.
It did, and that was one of the big connections too. It wasn't just the burned house of General Pershing, but it was also the adobe, the fact that these earliest buildings here were built in the same, you know, just mud brick. Just the same, we call it mud brick, you call it adobe, but it's basically the same thing, it's sun-dried brick. And that here it was, and you were revealing it. And it was just, I was so impressed. And look what those Victorians did over it, and they put all these wooden boards over it and hid this magnificent mud brick house. That, whereas what they would have done during the Spanish time is to do what they did 9,000 years ago in Turkey, which is to plaster it over and, you know, put layers and layers of plaster, which is perhaps what they did over in Dolores Park. I'm in the Mission Dolores, Mission whatever it is.
Yeah,
is that its right name? It's not really its proper name, is it? Anyway, the Mission of San Francisco. And I remembered that there was this whole argument that was going on at that time in 2005, 2006, I think it was 2005, which was the oldest building. And it seemed to me, oh my goodness, was it Mission Dolores or was it this building? And it's only 200 years old, and who cares which is the earliest building? And I do remember that. And but for you people, it was a big deal.
It was. That was funny. But I have to ask, you know, when you came in the room and you saw it peeled back and you saw that brick, was it surprising to see that same mud brick
Yes.
You say? Yeah.
Yes, it was very surprising. I had no idea that it was the same material and the same technique. I had somehow thought that it would be more what we call wattle and daub, which would be, you know, a wooden framework and basket and then with clay plopped on each side. But yet I should have known because Barbara Voss, who is also has in significantly, you know, affected the way I look at the Presidio, Barb Voss, when she was a graduate student, came and worked with us at Çatalhöyük in Turkey. And she came specifically to understand how to excavate mud brick. And somehow I hadn't put the two things together. Of course she wants to, you know, she's excavating here. So she came to Çatalhöyük to see how we excavated, how we dealt with documenting the mud brick architecture. And it was something she was using for her dissertation work. And that was in 1997 or 98 that she came to work with us. 1998 she came. And the very next year or that year she was excavating in the Presidio for her dissertation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And at El Pauline, I think she was doing it then too.
Yeah, she that's where she went shortly thereafter. Oh, that's funny. So if the, this is a kind of a random question, but if the, you know, as you've like delved into a lot of these stories, is there any particular character in the past? It doesn't have to be maybe a specific person, like General Pershing, but kind of a class of folk in the past that you wish you could kind of delve into their history and know a little bit about more about, you know, their sense of place or their understanding.
I suppose in a way, it's interesting that you ask that because in many ways, I'm really interested to know how did people who came by boat and then came, you know, to the harbor or jetty or however they got to the Presidio, how did they view the Presidio as they came to it in different periods of its history? You know, what? How did that change? Because, you know, what did it look like for them? How did they feel? I would love to. I think it would be a wonderful, wonderful thing to imagine. And that's what I do imagine. How did we know, you know, how the British naval person thought of it because he wrote about it. But many of them didn't write about it. There must have been hundreds of visiting ships bringing trading goods or just, you know, coming in for shelter or whatever. How did they, what was their impression of the Presidio of San Francisco? And how many of them would have continued round to where the little tiny town of Yerba Buena was beginning to grow up? You know, what was their impression as they saw these different places as visitors or as people coming to settle? I've been very interested in that.
Huh. Yeah, kind of their first impressions.
Yeah, their first impression. And the other thing, I mean, what, you know, as archaeologists of a certain kind, we are very interested in getting into this sensibilities or the perceptions of people in the everyday. Just the person who baked the bread. What did they do? What did people do? What did they see? What did they hear? What was their whole, what did they smell as they're walking around inside the Presidio? Did they see any, I'm very interested in the boundaries. Did they see any, was the Presidio wall, was it a real boundary for them? This is especially during the El Presidio times. Did they feel, now I'm in the Presidio, now I'm not in the Presidio? Do they know, you know, what's the boundary like for them? I think is a really interesting topic.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Because today there's a very clear boundary.
Yes, there is. Yeah, so, but the everyday and how that changes through time and just the regular people working, Not the commandant. I don't need to know about commandants. But those the Native Americans, you know, was the baker a Native American? Or was he not? She? Who was she? Was she? And children's viewpoints are also really interesting. It's good to think about everybody's perceptions, to use your imagination for that. I think it's very, very important. I'm telling you, there's a ton of imaginative stories to be written.
That's fantastic. It really is. Well, Ruth, I think we've come to our end of time.
Have we really?
Yeah.
Okay. Goodbye.
That was great. That was really fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Very fun.
It was really nice to listen.
I didn't keep it all to my script, but then we didn't have a script.
We did.